Hi there. Welcome to Classics for Kids. I'm your host, Carrie Sayer, here to continue the adventures of Peter Pan, written by J.M. Barrie. When we ended last time, Captain Hook was about to begin a guessing game with whomever was teasing him by copying his voice. Of course, we know it was Peter, but just listen as he tries to guess.
Hook, he called. Have you another voice?
Now Peter could never resist a game, and he answered blithely in his own voice. I have.
And another name?
Aye.
Vegetable?
Asked Hook. No.
Mineral?
No.
Animal?
Yes.
Man? No.
This answer ran out scornfully.
Boy?
Yes.
Ordinary boy?
No.
Wonderful boy?
To Wendy's pain, the answer that rang out this time was yes.
Are you in England?
No.
Are you here?
Yes. Hook was completely puzzled.
You ask him some questions,
he said to the others, wiping his damp brow. Smee reflected.
Oh, I can't think of a thing, he said regretfully.
Can't guess, crowed Peter. Do you give it up?
Of course, in his pride, he was carrying the game too far, and the miscreants saw their chance.
Yes, they answered eagerly.
Well, then, he cried, I am Peter Pan. In a moment, Hook was himself again, and Smee and Starkey were his faithful henchmen.
Now we have him, Hook shouted. Into the water, Smee. Starkey, mind the boat. Take him, dead or alive.
He leaped as he spoke, and simultaneously came the gay voice of Peter.
Are you ready, boys?
Aye, aye, from various parts of the lagoon. Then lam into the pirates!
The fight was short and sharp. First to draw blood was John, who gallantly climbed into the boat and held Starkey. There was a fierce struggle in which the cutlass was torn from the pirate's grasp. He wriggled overboard and John leapt after him. The dinghy drifted away. Here and there a head bobbed up in the water, and there was a flash of steel followed by a cry or a whoop. In the confusion, some struck at their own side. The corkscrew of Smee got Tootles in the fourth rib, but he was himself pinked in turn by Curly. Farther from the rock, Starkey was pressing slightly and the twins hard. Where all this time was Peter? He was seeking bigger game. The others were all brave boys, and they must not be blamed for backing from the pirate captain. His iron claw made a circle of dead water round him, from which they fled like affrighted fishes. But there was one who did not fear him. There was one prepared to enter that circle. Strangely, it was not in the water that they met. Hook rose to the rock to breathe, and at the same moment, Peter scaled it on the opposite side. The rock was slippery as a ball, and they had to crawl rather than climb. Neither knew that the other was coming. Each, feeling for a grip, met the other's arm. In surprise, they raised their heads. Their faces were almost touching, and so they met. Some of the greatest heroes have confessed that just before they fell to, they had a sinking. Had it been so with Peter at that moment, I would admit it. After all, this was the only man that the sea cook had feared. But Peter had no sinking. He had one feeling only, gladness, and he gnashed his pretty teeth with joy. Quick as thought, he snatched a knife from Hook's belt and was about to drive it home when he saw that he was higher up on the rock than his foe. It would not have been fighting fair. He gave the pirate a hand to help him up. It was then that Hook bit him. Not the pain of this, but its unfairness was what dazed Peter. It made him quite helpless. He could only stare, horrified. Every child is affected thus the first time he is treated unfairly. All he thinks he has a right to when he comes to you to be yours is fairness. After you have been unfair to him, he will love you again, but never afterwards be quite the same boy. No one ever gets over that first unfairness. No one except Peter. He often met it, but he always forgot it. I suppose that was the real difference between him and all the rest. So when he met it now, it was like the first time, and he could just stare, helpless. Twice the iron claw clawed him. A few minutes afterwards, the other boys saw Hook in the water striking wildly for the ship. No elation on his pestilent face now, only white fear, for the crocodile was in dogged pursuit of him. On ordinary occasions, the boys would have swum alongside, cheering, but now they were uneasy, for they had lost both Peter and Wendy and were scouring the lagoon for them, calling them by name. They found the dinghy and went home in it, shouting, "Peter! Wendy!" as they went, but no answer came, save mocking laughter from the mermaids. "They must be swimming back, or flying," the boys concluded. They were not very anxious. They had such faith in Peter. They chuckled, boy-like, because they would be late for bed, and it was all Mother Wendy's fault. When their voices died away, there came cold silence over the lagoon, and then a feeble cry. "Help! Help!" Two small figures were beating against the rock. The girl had fainted and lay on the boy's arm. With a last effort, Peter pulled her up on the rock and then lay down beside her. Even as he also fainted, he saw that the water was rising. He knew that they would soon be drowned, but he could do no more. As they lay side by side, a mermaid caught Wendy by the feet and began pulling her softly into the water. Peter, feeling her slip from him, woke with a start, and he was just in time to draw her back. But he had to tell her the truth. "We are on the rock, Wendy," he said, "but it is growing smaller. Soon the water will be over it." She did not understand even now.
"We must go," she said almost brightly.
"Yes," he answered faintly.
"Shall we swim or fly, Peter?"
He had to tell her. "Do you think you could swim or fly as far as the island, Wendy, without my help?" She had to admit that she was too tired. He moaned.
"What is it?" she asked, anxious about him at once.
"I can't help you, Wendy. Hook wounded me. I can neither fly nor swim."
"Do you mean we shall both be drowned?"
"Look how the water's rising."
They put their hands over their eyes to shut out the sight. They thought they would soon be no more. As they sat thus, something brushed against Peter as light as a kiss and stayed there, as if saying timidly, "Can I be of use?" It was the tail of a kite, which Michael had made some days before. It had torn itself out of his hand and floated away.
"Michael's kite," Peter said without interest, but next moment he had seized the tail and was pulling the kite toward him.
"It lifted Michael off the ground," he cried. "Why should it not carry you?"
"Both of us." "It can't lift two. Michael and Curly tried."
"Let's draw lots," Wendy said bravely.
"And you a lady? Never." Already he had tied the tail round her. She clung to him. She refused to go without him. But with a "Goodbye, Wendy," he pushed her from the rock, and in a few minutes she was borne out of his sight. Peter was alone on the lagoon. The rock was very small now. Soon it would be submerged. Pale rays of light tiptoed across the waters, and by there was to be heard a sound at once most musical and the most melancholy in the world, the mermaids calling to the moon. Peter was not quite like other boys, but he was afraid at last. A tremor ran through him, like a shudder passing over the sea. But on the sea, one shudder follows another till there are hundreds of them, and Peter felt just the one. Next moment, he was standing erect on the rock again, with that smile on his face and a drum beating within him. It was saying, "To die will be an awfully big adventure." Listen to this song just to remind us of who Peter really is.
I won't grow up.
I won't grow up.
I don't want to go to school.
I don't want to go to school.
Just to learn to be a parrot.
Just to learn to be a parrot.
And recite a silly rule.
And recite a silly rule.
If growing up means it would be beneath my dignity to climb a tree,
I'll never grow up, never grow up, never grow up.
Not me.
Not I.
Not me.
Not me.
I won't grow up.
I won't grow up.
And I wanna wear a tie.
I don't wanna wear a tie.
And a serious expression.
And a serious expression.
In the middle of July.
In the middle of July.
And if it means I must prepare to shoulder burdens with a worried air,
I'll never grow up, never grow up, never grow up.
Not me.
Not I.
Not me.
So there. Never gonna be a man.
I won't.
Like to see somebody try
and make me.
Anyone who wants to try and make me turn into a man. Catch me if you can. I won't grow up.
I won't grow up.
Not a penny will I pinch.
Not a penny will I pinch.
I will never grow a mustache.
I will never grow a mustache.
Or a fraction of an inch.
Or a fraction of an inch.
'Cause growing up is awful work. And all the awful things that ever were,
I'll never grow up, never grow up, never grow up.
No, sir.
Not I.
Not me.
So there.
I won't grow up.
I won't grow up.
I will never even try.
I will never even try.
I will do what Peter tells me.
I will do what Peter tells me.
And I'll never ask him why.
And I'll never ask him why.
We won't grow up.
We won't grow up.
We will never grow a day.
We will never grow a day.
And if someone tries to make us.
And if someone tries to make us.
We will simply run away.
We will simply run away.
I won't grow up.
I won't grow up.
No, I promise that I won't.
No, I promise that I won't.
I will stay a boy forever.
I will stay a boy forever.
And be banished if I don't.
And be banished if I don't.
Chapter 9. The Neverbird. The last sounds Peter heard before he was quite alone were the mermaids retiring one by one to their bedchambers under the sea. He was too far away to hear their doors shut, but every door in the coral caves where they live rings a tiny bell when it opens or closes, as in all the nicest houses on the mainland, and he heard the bells. Steadily the waters rose till they were nibbling at his feet, and to pass the time until they made their final gulp, he watched the only thing moving on the lagoon. He thought it was a piece of floating paper, perhaps part of the kite, and he wondered idly how long it would take to drift ashore. Presently he noticed as an odd thing that it was undoubtedly out upon the lagoon with some definite purpose, for it was fighting the tide, and sometimes winning, and when it won, Peter, always sympathetic to the weaker side, could not help clapping. It was such a gallant piece of paper. It was not really a piece of paper. It was the Neverbird, making desperate efforts to reach Peter on her nest. By working her wings in a way she had learned since the nest fell into the water, she was able to some extent to guide her strange craft. But by the time Peter recognized her, she was very exhausted. She had come to save him, to give him her nest, though there were eggs in it. I rather wonder at the bird, for though he had been nice to her, he had also sometimes tormented her. I can suppose only that, like Mrs. Darling and the rest of them, she was melted because he had all his first teeth. She called out to him what she had come for, and he called out to her what she was doing there, but of course neither of them understood the other's language. In fanciful stories, people can talk to the birds freely, and I wish for the moment I could pretend that this was such a story and say that Peter replied intelligently to the Neverbird, but truth is best, and I want to tell only what really happened. Well, not only could they not understand each other, but they forgot their manners.
"I want you to get into the nest," the bird called, speaking as slowly and distinctly as possible, "and then you can drift ashore. But I am too tired to bring it any nearer, so you must try to swim to it."
"What are you quacking about?" Peter answered. "Why don't you let the nest drift as usual?"
"I want you," the bird said, and repeated it all over.
Then Peter tried slow and distinct,
"What are you quacking about?"
and so on. The Neverbird became irritated. They have very short tempers.
"You dunderheaded little jay," she screamed. "Why don't you do as I tell you?"
Peter felt that she was calling him names, and at a venture he retorted hotly,
"So are you."
Then, rather curiously, they both snapped out the same remark,
"Shut up! Shut up!"
Nevertheless, the bird was determined to save him if she could, and by one last mighty effort, she propelled the nest against the rock. Then up she flew, deserting her eggs, so as to make her meaning clear. Then at last he understood, and clutched the nest and waved his thanks to the bird as she fluttered overhead. It was not to receive his thanks, however, that she hung there in the sky. It was not even to watch him get into the nest. It was to see what he did with her eggs. There were two large white eggs, and Peter lifted them up and reflected. The bird covered her face with her wings so as to not see the last of her eggs, but she could not help peeping between the feathers. I forget whether I have told you that there was a stave on the rock, driven into it by some buccaneers of long ago, to mark the site of buried treasure. The children had discovered the glittering hoard, and when in mischievous mood used to fling showers of moidores, diamonds, pearls, and pieces of eight out to the gulls, who pounced upon them for food, and then flew away, raging at the scurvy trick that had been played upon them. The stave was still there, and on it Starkey had hung his hat, a deep tarpaulin, watertight, with a broad brim. Peter put the eggs into this hat and set it on the lagoon. It floated beautifully. The Neverbird saw at once what he was up to and screamed her admiration of him, and at last Peter crowed his agreement with her. Then he got into the nest, reared the stave in it as a mast, and hung up his shirt for a sail. At the same moment the bird fluttered down upon the hat and once more sat snugly on her eggs. She drifted in one direction, and he was borne off in another, both cheering. Of course, when Peter landed, he beached his bark in a place where the bird would easily find it. But the hat was such a great success that she abandoned her nest. It drifted about till it went to pieces, and often Starkey came to the shore of the lagoon and, with many bitter feelings, watched the bird sitting on his hat. As we shall not see her again, it may be worth mentioning here that all Neverbirds now build in that shape of a nest, with a broad brim on which the youngsters take an airing. Great were the rejoicings when Peter reached the home under the ground almost as soon as Wendy, who had been carried hither and thither by the kite. Every boy had adventures to tell, but perhaps the biggest adventure of all was that they were several hours late for bed. This so inflated them that they did various dodgy things to get staying up later, such as demanding bandages. But Wendy, though glorying in having them all home again safe and sound, was scandalized by the lateness of the hour and cried, "To bed! To bed!" in a voice that had to be obeyed. Next day, however, she was awfully tender and gave out bandages to everyone, and they played till bedtime at limping about and carrying their arms in slings. Chapter 10. The Happy Home. One important result of the brush on the lagoon was that it made the Indians their friends. Peter had saved Tiger Lily from a dreadful fate, and now there was nothing she and her braves would not do for him. All night they sat above, keeping watch over the home under the ground and awaiting the big attack by the pirates, which obviously could not be much longer delayed. Even by day they hung about, smoking the pipe of peace, looking almost as if they wanted tidbits to eat. They called Peter the Great White Father, prostrating themselves before him, and he liked this tremendously, so that it was not really good for him. "The Great White Father," he would say to them in a very lordly manner as they groveled at his feet, "is glad to see that the Piccaninny warriors are protecting his wigwam from the pirates."
"I'm Tiger Lily," that lovely creature would reply. "Peter Pan saved me. Me his very nice friend. Me no let pirates hurt him."
She was far too pretty to cringe in this way, but Peter thought it was his due, and he would answer condescendingly, "It is good. Peter Pan has spoken." Always when he said, "Peter Pan has spoken," it meant that they must now shut up, and they accepted it humbly in that spirit. But they were by no means so respectful of the other boys, whom they looked upon as just ordinary braves. They said, "How do?" to them, and things like that. And what annoyed the boys was that Peter seemed to think this was all right. Secretly, Wendy sympathized with them a little, but she was far too loyal a housewife to listen to any complaints against Father. "Father knows best," she always said, whatever her private opinion must be. Her private opinion was that the Indians should not call her a squaw. We now have reached the evening that was to be known among them as the Night of Nights, because of its adventures and their upshot. The day, as if quietly gathering its forces, had been almost uneventful, and now the Indians in their blankets were at their posts above, while below the children were having their evening meal, all except Peter, who had gone out to get the time. The way you got the time on the island was to find the crocodile and then stay near him until the clock struck. This meal happened to be a make-believe tea, and they sat round the board guzzling in their greed, and really, what with their chatter and recriminations, the noise, as Wendy said, was positively deafening. To be sure, she did not mind noise, but she simply would not have them grabbing things and then excusing themselves by saying that Toodles had pushed their elbow. There was a fixed rule that they must never hit back at meals, but should refer the matter of dispute to Wendy by raising the right arm politely and saying, "I complain of so-and-so." But what usually happened was that they forgot to do this, or did it too much. "Silence!" cried Wendy, when for the 20th time she had told them that they were not all to speak at once. "Is your calabash empty, Slightly, darling?" "Not quite empty, Mummy," Slightly said, after looking into an imaginary mug. "He hasn't even begun to drink his milk," Nibs interposed. This was telling, and Slightly seized his chance. "I complain of Nibs," he cried promptly. John, however, had held up his hand first. "Well, John?" "May I sit in Peter's chair as he is not here?" "Sit in Father's chair, John?" Wendy was scandalized. "Certainly not." "He's not really our father," John answered. "He didn't even know how a father does till I showed him." This was grumbling. "We complain of John," cried the twins. Toodles held up his hand. He was so much the humblest of them, indeed he was the only humble one, that Wendy was specially gentle with him. "I don't suppose," Toodles said diffidently, "that I could be father." "No, Toodles." Once Toodles began, which was not very often, he had a silly way of going on and on. "As I can't be father," he said heavily, "I don't suppose, Michael, you would let me be baby." "No, I won't," Michael rapped out. He was already in his basket. "As I can't be baby," Toodles said, getting heavier and heavier, "do you think I could be a twin?" "No, indeed," replied the twins. "It's awfully difficult to be a twin." "As I can't be anything important," said Toodles, "would any of you like to see me do a trick?" "No," they all replied. Then at last he stopped. "I hadn't really any hope," he said. The hateful telling broke out again. "Slightly's coughing on the table. The twins began with Mammy apples. Curly's taking both tapper rolls and yams. Nibs is speaking with his mouth full. I complain of the twins. I complain of Curly. I complain of Nibs.
oh dear," cried Wendy. "I'm sure I sometimes think that children are more trouble than they are worth." She told them to clear away and sat down to her work basket, a heavy load of stockings and every knee with a hole in it as usual. "Wendy," remonstrated Michael, "I'm too big for a cradle." "I must have somebody in a cradle," she said almost tartly, "and you are the littlest. A cradle is such a nice, homely thing to have about a house." While she sewed, they played around her, such a group of happy faces and dancing limbs lit up by that romantic fire. It had become a very familiar scene, this, in the home under the ground, but we are looking on it for the last time. There was a step above, and Wendy, you may be sure, was the first to recognize it. "Children, I hear your father's step. He likes you to meet him at the door." Above, the Indians crouched before Peter. "Watch well, braves. I have spoken." And then, as so often before, the gay children dragged him from his tree. As so often before, but never again. He had brought nuts for the boys as well as the correct time for Wendy. "Peter, you just spoil them, you know," Wendy simpered.
"Ah, old lady," said Peter, hanging up his gun.
"It was me told him mothers are called old lady," Michael whispered to Curly. "I complain of Michael," said Curly instantly. The first twin came to Peter. "Father, we want to dance."
"Dance away, my little man," said Peter, who was in high good humor.
"But we want you to dance."
Peter was really the best dancer among them, but he pretended to be scandalized.
"Me? My old bones would rattle."
"And Mummy, too."
"What?" cried Wendy. "The mother of such an armful? Dance?
But on a Saturday night," slightly insinuated.
That's where we're going to have to stop for tonight. Well, thank you for listening to Peter Pan. Thanks for listening to KTNA Talkeetna and Classics for Kids. Please stay tuned for Encounters, and I'll read you some more Peter Pan next week.